Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Handguns in the Home Pre-Argument Debate Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On September 30th, 2009, the Supreme Court granted certiorari in the case of McDonald v. City of Chicago on the question of whether the Due Process Clause or the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment makes the Second Amendment applicable to the states and invalidates Chicago's ordinance prohibiting the possession of handguns in the home. To discuss the privileges or immunities question, we have Institute for Justice Senior Attorney Clark Neely and Loyola Law School Professor Kurt Lash. George Mason University School of Law Professor Nelson Lund will moderate the discussion. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, I will turn this over to Professor Lund.
This is Nelson Lund from George Mason Law School. We're here today to talk about the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment and its application in a case now before the U.S. Supreme Court involving the right to keep and bear arms. I'm here today to discuss the issues with two very knowledgeable experts in the field. First, Clark Neely, who's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. He was also co-counsel for the plaintiffs in District of Columbia versus Heller, which was decided last year, and I'll talk about that case a little bit in a moment. Also here with us is Kurt Lash. He's the James P. Bradley Professor of Constitutional Law at Loyola Law School and past chair of the AALS section on constitutional law. Next year, he'll be moving to the University of Illinois, where he will co-direct the program on constitutional theory, history, and law. I'm just going to try to set up the issues, a little background and issues a little bit, and then Clark and Kurt are going to give their views, and then we'll discuss them. As most of the listeners undoubtedly know, the Supreme Court decided last year in the Heller case that the right to keep and bear arms protected by the Second Amendment is an individual right, and the court struck down a ban on possession of handguns in the District of Columbia. Now, since 1833, the court has held the Bill of Rights applies only to the federal government, so the Heller decision left untouched the authority of state governments to regulate or even prohibit the possession of weapons. After the Heller decision came down, Chicago's gun control law, which is quite similar to the one struck down in Heller, was challenged under the 14th Amendment. That challenge is now before the Supreme Court in a case styled McDonald versus City of Chicago. Now, in resolving this case, there are two different approaches that the court might take. As most of you undoubtedly know, most provisions, not all, but most provisions of the Bill of Rights have been applied to the states through 14th Amendment substantive due process under what's called the incorporation doctrine or selective incorporation doctrine. The court has never ruled one way or the other on whether the right to arms is incorporated against the states under that doctrine. The court's precedent strongly supports Second Amendment incorporation, but the whole doctrine has little or no support in the original meaning of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. So there's an alternative the court might take, and that's to consider incorporation through the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment says, and I'm quoting, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States." The text of the Constitution doesn't tell us what these privileges or immunities are, so courts and commentators have looked for guidance primarily to the legislative history, broadly understood. In the famous, or as it may be infamous, slaughterhouse cases in 1873, the court read the clause narrowly, holding that it embraces only those individual rights, and here I'm quoting again, that owe their existence to the federal government, its national character, its constitution, or its laws. 2 years later, in United States versus Cruikshank, the court specifically held that the right to keep and bear arms is not one of the rights protected by the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Now, both Slaughterhouse and Cruikshank have been subjected to a great deal of academic criticism, but there's no consensus on what interpretation of the 14th Amendment should replace the one that was adopted in those cases. Various commentators have focused on different parts of the legislative history, and they've come up with a bewildering array of alternatives. I think there are four main theories. which I'll just summarize very briefly and somewhat crudely before Clark and Kent offer their views. The first theory is that the Privileges or Immunities Clause does not provide substantive protection for any specific set of rights at all, but rather is an anti-discrimination provision modeled on the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4. Article 4, of course, prohibits the states from discriminating against out-of-staters with respect to certain state law rights. So under this first theory, the 14th Amendment prohibits the states from discriminating against disfavored classes of their own citizens with respect to those same state law rights. A second theory is that the 14th Amendment prohibits all state laws that are arbitrary or unreasonable. A third theory is that the 14th Amendment gives substantive protection to a class of natural rights, including the economic rights that later came to be associated with the court's Lochner-era jurisprudence. A fourth theory is that the Privileges or Immunities Clause was meant to apply the Federal Bill of Rights against the state governments, but nothing more. Advocates of each theory have found support in the legislative history, and we're obviously not going to be able to evaluate all the historical evidence in this podcast, but maybe we can make a start at it, and maybe the Supreme Court will be able to finish the job when it issues its opinion in the McDonald case this term. With that, I'll turn it over to Clark Neely to give his views on how the case should be resolved by the court.
Well, thanks, Nelson, and thanks to Kurt for participating in the debate and the Federalist Society for giving us the opportunity. I think McDonald may be the most important 14th Amendment case to come to the court, perhaps even in a century. I've described this as being somewhat like, if you're interested in the 14th Amendment, it's a bit like being a cell biologist on the day the microscope was invented. This is really the first time the court will have the opportunity to conduct a genuinely originalist look at the 14th Amendment, which is something that, amazingly, the court has never done in the 130-something years since the amendment, the 140-something years since the amendment was ratified. So it's a very exciting opportunity. The general consensus seems to be that whether the right to keep and bear arms will be held enforceable against state and local governments is a fairly easy question, and the answer is yes. The question, as Nelson suggested, that's really interesting in this case is how will the court go about enforcing the right to keep and bear arms against the states, assuming that it does so. And notice that I don't use the term incorporation, and that's for a reason. I reject the mental imagery that comes with that metaphor because it makes it sound as if the role of the 14th Amendment is to sort of function as a kind of mechanical device that reaches into the Bill of Rights, grabs rights that are sufficiently fundamental, and then sort of plops them down against the states. I think that's a very unfortunate way of conceiving it, even though it has been the way that the Supreme Court has framed the issue. I think a much better and a more originalist way to approach the 14th Amendment is to recognize that the centerpiece of the amendment really was intended and understood to be the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which, as Nelson mentioned, the court essentially wrote out of the Constitution in the the Slaughterhouse cases and in Cruikshank and its progeny. The Privileges or Immunities Clause, when you go back and look at the history, seems to have served a relatively clear purpose. And that was to not only empower, but in fact to charge the federal government, including the federal courts, with the duty of helping stamp out a culture of slavery, tyranny, and oppression that remained in the South in the wake of the Civil War, notwithstanding the Northern victory and notwithstanding the ratification of the 13th Amendment that represented the end of legal slavery in America. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court chose to defy that purpose. In what I consider to be perhaps the most activist decision the Supreme Court has ever handed down, if we define activism as repudiating the will of the people as expressed in law or their founding document, the Constitution, then I think by any measure, the Slaughterhouse cases were a glaring example of judicial activism, recognized as such at the time, because essentially what they did was refuse to give any meaningful content to the 14th Amendment and interpret it instead as creating essentially two distinct classes of citizenship so that from that point forward, Americans were both citizens of the United States, but also citizens of the state in which they resided. And the court said that essentially we have two different, and in Cruikshank said mutually exclusive, sets of rights that flow from those two distinct citizenships. As to the first set, rights we have as United States citizens, these included, according to the Slaughterhouse majority, things like the right of access to navigable waterways, the right to invoke the protection of the federal government when on the high seas, and access to sub-treasuries. Note that none of these were rights or values over which the Civil War was fought, and none of these were rights or values the violation of which by the states led to the adoption and ratification of the 14th Amendment. Instead, the Slaughterhouse Court put the rights that really were at issue in those conflicts, namely things like the ability to speak freely, the ability to move about freely, the ability to be armed, to resist mobs and lynchings. All of those rights, the Slaughterhouse Court put in the category of rights of state citizenship and said that to for the protection of those rights, people must look to state governments. Well, this was an inherently ludicrous thing to do. It was at war with the history and context of the 14th Amendment, and it's not surprising that Justice Miller, in the majority decision, simply ignored all of that history and that context. And as contemporary legal commentator Christopher Tideman noted, dared to withstand the will of the people as expressed in the 14th Amendment, again by draining it of all real meaning. And he did so for overtly consequentialist reasons. Justice Miller and the majority in Slaughterhouse seemed to believe that shifting so much power from the states to the federal government, making the federal government a, quote, perpetual censor on state legislation, was improvident, even though it was rather clearly the intention of the people who ratified the 14th Amendment. Unfortunately, as we know, this led to essentially the court standing by idly while the black codes multiplied and ultimately turned into Jim Crow, and led to the Supreme Court refusing to enforce some of the most fundamental rights of American citizens, at least as to violations perpetrated by state and local governments. Of course, the Supreme Court eventually got off the bench and started enforcing individual rights against the states, but it did so through the doctrine of substantive due process and incorporation. This is a doctrine that has been much disparaged, even though I think it has more historical legitimacy than many of its critics give it. But what it refused to do was to ever go back and attempt to recover a genuinely originalist interpretation of the 14th Amendment. That is something the court still has not done to this day, and the McDonald case presents a wonderful opportunity to do that, because in McDonald, what you have is a clearly fundamental and in some ways particularly American right, the right of armed self-defense, the right to keep and bear arms. And the Supreme Court has never undertaken the analysis to determine whether the right to keep and bear arms is enforceable against state and local governments. And so it's an exciting opportunity, but not only for the question of whether the right to keep and bear arms should apply against the states, but for what, if any, other rights should also be protected by the Privileges or Immunities Clause based on a truly originalist reading, which, again, the court has never even attempted, let alone achieved. And so I think that this could be the beginning of a truly interesting and hopefully more genuine, more intellectually honest engagement with the 14th Amendment. And so it's a very exciting term, and we'll have to simply wait and see what interest the court expresses in terms of possibly revisiting the damage that it did to the 14th Amendment and the Privileges and Immunities Clause specifically in Slaughterhouse and its progeny. And I think I'll stop there.
Hey, thanks very much, Clark. Do you want to respond, Kurt, or give your views?
Certainly. And again, thanks, Nelson, and thanks to the Federal Society and to Clark for letting me be a part of this podcast debate. I think that Clark makes a number of important points that I completely agree with. I think that he's certainly correct that the court's approach to substantive due process and the 14th Amendment in general has wrongly ignored its historical context. And I also agree that the McDonald case provides a great opportunity to build upon their interest in history that was reflected in the Heller decision and gives them and the country an opportunity to take another look and a long overdue look at the historical understanding of the Privileges or Immunities Clause and move the focus of the rights of the 14th Amendment back to what I also agree is really was the central and most important clause, that first part of Section 1 dealing with privileges or immunities. I also agree that Heller should be extended. I think that the historical record certainly supports incorporation of the Second Amendment. I think that Clark's right. I think the consensus is that the court is quite likely to do that. However, in doing so, I would disagree that Slaughterhouse should be overruled. I think that move is unnecessary, and I actually think it would be a constitutional historical error to do that. As I understand it, there are two main options open to the court in terms of incorporating the Second Amendment. One approach would be to focus narrowly on the issue of incorporation of the Bill of Rights. A second approach would be to seek or perhaps embrace a much broader reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which sweeps well beyond the Bill of Rights and actually would include a number of unenumerated rights as identified by the court as well. Now, in my work, I've long supported the first approach. I think that incorporation of the Bill of Rights is historically supported. I think there certainly was a broad public development that looked towards the Bill of Rights in the period between the founding and the Civil War. And even though the original bill just bound the federal government, I think more and more you have political debate embracing the idea that the rights listed in the Bill of Rights really represented freedoms and liberties which belong to all American citizens and ought to be protected against both federal and state action. And you can get statements expressly from the man who framed Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, John Bingham, who expressly said that he understood the Privileges or Immunities Clause to include the liberties listed in the first 8 amendments to the Constitution. So I think that there is history, and I certainly think it's persuasive history, that the Privileges or Immunities Clause, as drafted and as originally understood, embraced the first 8 amendments. But there's a second and a broader approach that Clark kind of hints at and is tilting towards, and you can also see it in the briefs filed in the McDonald's case, particularly the historian's brief, which asked the court to go beyond the issue of incorporating the Bill of Rights, but to read privileges and immunities as also including and also as authorizing the courts to identify and enforce against state laws unenumerated rights that the court identifies as being fundamental enough to deserve judicial protection. I don't think that this second view, this broader view, really reflects the original understanding of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And I think if the court were to embrace that approach, it would substantially undermine the federalist structure of the Constitution and even the idea of general separation of powers. The arguments that are generally in support of this broader reading tend to look towards the comparisons between the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4. And the argument is there were antebellum cases like Corfield against Coryell by Justice Washington that talked about Article 4 privileges and immunities as including fundamental rights, which had always been protected by the state. And you do have that case and that language of fundamental rights being raised by a number of members of the 39th Congress, who also looked to Corfield and argued that those same privileges or immunities had become part of the 14th Amendment protected against state action. In addition to that, you also see the broader, the scholars in favor of the broader reading, also talking about the 9th Amendment, and the fact that it seems to call into play other rights than those listed in the Bill of Rights. And if that's in the 9th Amendment, we certainly shouldn't read the Privileges or Immunities Clause as only incorporating the Bill of Rights. The problem, though, as I see it, with both of those arguments, is that they focus only on a certain portion of the historical record. It is true that there were some radical Republicans in the 39th Congress who talked about Corfield and fundamental rights, but their approach and their attempt to broaden federal control over federal over common law rights was rejected by the majority of the Reconstruction Congress and certainly was rejected by the moderate Republicans. John Bingham expressly described the Privileges or Immunities Clause as having nothing to do with Corfield or Article 4, and he stood up and interrupted any Republican who tried to argue otherwise on the floor of the House. By doing that and by limiting privileges or immunities, as he put it, to just the first 8 amendments, he was reflecting an attitude by the moderate Republicans that even though they wanted to protect a new group of national rights, such as those listed in the first 8 amendments, they didn't want to destroy the general federalist structure of the Constitution and the general principle of limited federal power. And any attempt to authorize federal authority or to nationalize the extremely broad scope of topics covered by the common law would, in fact, destroy that separation of power between local matters and national matters, and that's why it was rejected by moderate Republicans. And here I would rely on a lot of historical work by people like Earl Maltz or William Nelson, Dan Hamilton, and a number of others who have talked about how, surprising as it might seem, the moderate Republicans wanted to preserve this idea of certain matters being left to the states. they wanted equal protection, they certainly would have opposed, their original vision would have opposed the black codes as a matter of equal protection. But in terms of nationalizing rights, you have people like John Bingham saying, and here I want to quote John Bingham, the proposition pending before the House, the 14th Amendment, is simply a proposition to arm the Congress of the United States by the consent of the people of the United States with the power to enforce the Bill of Rights as it stands in the Constitution today. It hath that extent, no more. Again, wanted to accomplish new rights, but didn't want to go further in terms of this broad authorization of federal courts or federal Congress. So just in conclusion, so we can open it up and have a broader discussion. What I would argue is that this means that when Justice Miller in Slaughterhouse refused to read the Privileges or Immunities Clause as federalizing the infinite subjects of the common law, I think he was following the views of the man who actually drafted the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And I also think when he insisted that there was a distinction between the common law privileges or immunities of citizens in the states protected by Article 4 and the federal privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States protected by the 14th Amendment, again, he was following the express instructions of John Bingham. So in terms of the case before the court right now, I think that the court should overrule Cruikshank, the case that actually rejected Second Amendment incorporation. But I think that's a case to be overruled, not Slaughterhouse. You can get incorporation of the Second Amendment without destroying federalism, and I think that's the better approach.
Thank you. This is Nelson again. Thank you very much. I have some questions, but Clark, did you want to respond first? That would be fine.
Thanks, Nelson. This is Clark. It sounds like there are some fairly broad areas of agreement between me and Kurt, but there are some important areas of disagreement. I'll just touch on a couple of those briefly. It seems to me that the most important question you can look at when trying to understand the meaning of the 14th Amendment and the Privileges or Immunities Clause specifically is what was the evil at hand for correction? And that's the exact language that the court uses when trying to interpret terms that are unfamiliar. And the Privileges and Immunities Clause is unfamiliar to this generation, although I think the history is quite clear that it was less so at the time that it was written into Article 4 of the original Constitution and at the time it was written into the 14th Amendment as the Privileges or Immunities Clause. So the evil at hand for correction was actually fairly clear. It was the persistence of a state of constructive servitude throughout the South. And in trying to establish or determine what the framers and ratifiers of the 14th Amendment, and specifically the Privileges or Immunities Clause, intended those things to achieve, I think you really have to look at what was going on, what was the evil at hand for correction, and essentially what it was a state of a constructive servitude, as I said. And so the logical implication to me is that the provisions they enacted in order to eliminate that problem need to be sufficiently broad and effective to actually root out not only the specific legal codes, the black codes, but also the entire culture of oppression and tyranny. And I'm not convinced that simply enforcing the first eight amendments to the Constitution would achieve that objective. In fact, I think it's quite clear that it would not. And second, the only other point I'll make at this stage is that when John Bingham and others referred to the Bill of Rights in the congressional debates, it is not clear, and in fact there's substantial reason to believe, that they weren't referring to the Bill of Rights as a term of art the way we think of it today, and they did not necessarily mean the first 8 or 10 amendments to the Constitution, that what they may instead have meant was a somewhat more amorphous collection of rights that would include some of the rights articulated by Justice Washington in Corfield, rights that were understood to be sprinkled throughout the Constitution, particularly Article 1, Section 9, and elsewhere. And I note that in the provision that Kurt just quoted from the Congressional Globe, which I have in front of me, it's somewhat interesting to me that actually the term Bill of Rights in that passage, which is on page 1088 of Congressional Globe, is in lowercase. It's not in capital letters the way we would have it today. And so that is not obviously dispositive. But as I said, I think there are significant historical reasons to believe that when John Bingham and others were talking about the Bill of Rights, they may not have meant exactly the same thing by that term that we do today. And I'll stop there.
Okay, this is Nelson. Maybe I could follow up with one question for Clark. Given your understanding of the evil that was to be corrected, I gather that you reject the anti-discrimination theory or the anti-discrimination interpretation of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Can you explain why you reject that, if you do? And maybe I should add that this is not a fringe theory. It was articulated by the late David Curry from the University of Chicago and at much greater length by John Harrison at the University of Virginia. And in a lot of these discussions, it doesn't get a lot of attention. But I wonder if you could respond to whether you think that's wrong, and if so, why, given your understanding of the animating purpose of the 14th Amendment.
Thanks, Nelson. This is Clark again. I do reject the anti-discrimination theory of the 14th Amendment and the Privileges or Immunities Clause emphatically. And there's a very simple reason for that. One of the evils at hand for correction, both in the pre-war era and in Reconstruction era, was, for example, the suppression of abolition or later equality-related speech. And both blacks and whites were forbidden from advocating abolition or equality. And so a pure sort of non-discrimination or equality-based approach to the 14th Amendment would not have enabled the federal courts to get at that kind of censorship. And it's abundantly clear from the historical record that being able to do just that was one of the things that was very much on the minds of the people who wrote and ratified the 14th Amendment. And there's a whole host of other laws and systems that were in place at the time that would essentially fall within that same category. So specific to guns, for example, there were laws that said that the only kind of gun you could own was an army or a navy, a revolver. And the reason for that is not because they were particularly high quality or anything like that. It was because they were particularly expensive. And if you said the only gun somebody can own is one of these Navy pistols, then you're pretty sure that basically only white people are going to be able to have that gun, even though you haven't been overtly discriminatory. There were similar laws, for example, with curfew laws. There were laws that prevented what are called emigrant agents. These are people recruiting labor from cotton plantations in Mississippi and Texas from coming to recruit newly freed blacks to move to states where they're paying higher wages. All of these laws that were integral to perpetuating this system of constructive servitude throughout the South applied equally to whites and blacks. And a mere anti-discrimination or equality-based approach to the 14th Amendment would not have enabled the federal courts to root out those evils. And the people who wrote the 14th Amendment were very aware of the existence of those laws. And I think that is the most fundamental problem. There are others, but that to me is the most fundamental problem with the purely anti-discrimination or equality-based interpretation of the 14th Amendment.
Oh, thanks. This is Nelson again. I want to ask Kurt a variation on the same question.
Sure.
I had always understood that at least one of the main purposes of the 14th Amendment was to put on unquestionable constitutional grounds Section 1 of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which, of course, was an anti-discrimination provision. And so I wondered, given your understanding of the relatively limited purpose of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, can you explain why you think the anti-discrimination theory is incorrect?
Certainly, and this is Kurt Lash. I also agree with Clark and much of what Clark just said, that even though, Nelson, I think you're right, that obviously they wanted to make sure that they had adopted an amendment which included a provision granting federal power to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And I think that the powers in Section 5, and I think that you find the equality provision, which would justify the Civil Rights Act of 1866 in the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. But I also would agree with Clark that people like John Bingham, and I think the majority of Congress at the time, wanted to go further and wanted to not only protect certain equality norms. I might go further than Clark. I think that actually getting equality norms went a long way towards remedying a lot of the evils that were being introduced by way of the Black Codes. But still, there was a sufficient group in Congress who wanted to go further and protect substantive national rights. And I would agree with the scholarship of people like Professor Michael Ken Curtis, who've talked about freedom of speech and freedom of association as being a substantive right that would have gone beyond the equal protection norms of the Civil Rights Act. And again, in general, the Bill of Rights and the first eight amendments as being substantive rights that they wanted to protect. And again, you have John Bingham not just using the language of the Bill of Rights, and I agree with Clark that sometimes that wasn't always clear what they meant by that, but Bingham clarified exactly what he meant by that. He spoke specifically of the first eight amendments, and so did Howard when he was talking about the Privileges or Immunities Clause. So I think you have a focus on the specific amendments that, of course, didn't include the Ninth or Tenth Amendment. Now, Clark makes an important argument and a very important point. You want to interpret this clause in light of the evils to be addressed, and there's a presumption, of course, that they would have known what they were doing and that they would have drafted a clause that remedied the evils that they thought needed to be remedied. But I think that it's important to understand, of course, that there was disagreement in Congress and disagreement among the Republicans about what, in fact, would be the broad and sufficient constitutional provisions to remedy the evils that they had identified. And you have different groups advocating broader and narrower approaches. You do have radical Republicans talking about Wilson and others who are talking about wanting to grant full power to the federal government to decide what civil rights ought to be, and that they should be able to federalize all the areas of the common law, such as those addressed under Article 4, and make those now a matter of national norms. That was one approach and one argument in favor of what they thought would be an adequate remedy to the evil that they were seeing appearing in the South. But that was consistently rejected. Efforts to authorize full power to enforce civil rights was rejected and taken out of the language of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. They made it more specific in terms of what they were protecting. Language of broad civil rights or common law protections was taken out of the language of the 14th Amendment, again for reasons due to worries about a broad expansionist reading of that. And ultimately what controlled the day was the position of the moderates, who disagreed with how much power and how much intrusion had to be placed upon the states. They agreed there had to be substantive norms, so I think it did go beyond equal protection, but they were not willing to authorize later Congresses, which might be dominated by Democrats, and they didn't want to authorize the courts, which could do things like Dred Scott, to make up and to identify for their own purposes what fundamental rights ought to be. The consensus position was, well, we want to do more, but let's limit it to those things which the people themselves have identified as important rights in the text of the Constitution.
Good, thanks. This is Nelson again. I want to follow up with about that point with Clark in a moment, but first, if I could ask one question about the scope of the coverage of privileges and immunities to Kurt. Given your understanding, is the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment incorporated against the states?
That's been a controversial subject, one that Akil Amar, of course, has written on, who has argued that, in fact, the Establishment Clause was not considered an individual right capable or understood as being protected against state action. I disagree with Professor Amar on that particular point. In my look at the historical record, and I think it's wonderful that Clark has the Globe right there in front of them, my understanding is that they were well aware of the Southern establishment of religion and the state control of religion that controlled the actual content of sermons that could be preached to slaves and controlled which portions of the New Testament could actually be spoken of in public and at what time and who could be a part of congregations and things like that. So I think, as I understand the historical record, they understood the danger of state control of and state establishment of religion with all the power and mechanisms that go, enforcement mechanisms that go along with that. So I believe that there's sufficient reason to incorporate the Establishment Clause along with the Free Exercise Clause, although I'm aware that the debate continues along those lines. But I think the court was justified in doing that, incorporating
it. Thanks. This is Nelson again. Coming back to Clark and following up on what Kurt was saying before, can you provide a description of exactly what are the privileges and immunities covered by the 14th Amendment that is more precise than the usual language of fundamental rights, or more precise than, you know, the kind of things that people were worried about in the mid-19th century after the Civil War?
Yeah, I mean, I think, this is Clark again, the difficulty, of course, whenever you're dealing with a not fully enumerated or non-specific provision in the Constitution is that, you know, you can essentially get into a position where people say, well, where do you find that right? And any right that someone might mention, it's easy to say, well, why didn't they just write that in the Constitution? Which actually leads me to a point. I'll get back to the question in just 2 seconds, but it leads me to a point I wanted to make in response to Kurt's point about the Bill of Rights. I actually think the history is more contestable than perhaps he acknowledges. First of all, I think that if the Reconstruction Republicans, or I should say that the people in Congress who you know agreed on the text of the 14th Amendment, and he describes there being a consensus that federal courts should not be given full power to define civil rights. If there was that consensus, it seems logical that they would have simply said something along the lines of the states have to respect the provisions of the Bill of Rights. And, of course, that's a point that's been made many times by other scholars, and I think it has force. It's not definitive, but it's I think it gives one pause to say, well, why did they use privileges or immunities if they could have simply said from now on the Bill of Rights will be enforceable against the states and Barron v. Baltimore is overruled? The second thing that I think is quite contestable is whether Reconstruction Republicans, including Bingham, really did have a clear and consistent understanding of the Article IV Privileges and Immunities Clause and understood it either as an anti-discrimination provision or as not conferring any substantive rights. I think that Michael Ken Curtis, for example, and others attribute to those individuals a much different understanding of the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article IV, and that it includes a broader set of rights, which I'll now try to describe in response to Nelson's question. And I think it's essentially a situation where the more central a particular right was to the problems that were evident at the time and that Congress received testimony about and seemed to be sort of most troubled by, then the more certain we can be that that right is protected by the Privileges or Immunities Clause. We've already covered freedom of speech, which was viciously suppressed throughout the South, at least when it pertained to abolitionism, both before and after the Civil War, so I think that clearly goes on the list. Plainly, the right to keep and bear arms and to armed self-defense goes on the list because Congress received reams of testimony about the systematic disarmament of blacks and whites throughout the South to make them easier to terrorize and to lynch. And I would add both property, because that is mentioned over and over again in the congressional debates over the 14th Amendment and is mentioned in the Civil Rights Bill. So I think that goes on the list. And not only because it was mentioned, but because it was quite clear during the time that the inability to hold property or to be secure in one's holding of property was a huge problem for newly freed blacks. There were laws that forbade people from renting property to newly freed blacks so they couldn't have a place to live or make a living. And I would add to property the basic ability to make a living, because after all, what is more defining of constructive servitude or just plain servitude than owing one's livelihood or existence to somebody else? So I think that the ability to provide for oneself, to be autonomous, it was at the very heart of what was going on in the South, and the attempt of recalcitrant Southern states to deny that ability to newly freed blacks, to keep them in a state of constructive servitude, was at the very heart of the post-Civil War slave culture, and I'm quite confident that the framers of the 14th Amendment intended at least to root that out.
This is good. Thank you. This is Nelson again. We're almost out of time. Did you want to take a crack at responding to that specifically, Kurt?
Well, I think that Clark has raised raised a number of very important points in terms of how clear is the historical record. If there was a debate about Article 4 in the 39th Congress, and I think there was a debate about Article 4 in the 39th Congress, who had the more plausible understanding of Article 4? And then also the idea of privileges or immunities. You know, if they just meant the Bill of Rights, why didn't they just say the Bill of Rights? I think these are all very important questions. Now, the answers, of course, would extend us, you know, a little bit beyond our time here. But I think we can at least agree that what we are looking for, or at least a place to begin looking for these answers, would include the globe, right? Would include, and hopefully we're looking at a court that will go back to the globe and will take another look at these discussions of privileges or immunities and what exactly the meaning of Article 4 was. And my brief response, and again, as I read the history, but of course what both Clark and I are hoping is that at the very least we'll get the court to pay attention to the history. I believe that Article 4, and I'm publishing a paper on this with Georgetown Law Journal this coming year, Article 4 had been consistently interpreted as only involving granting sojourning citizens equal access to a limited set of state-conferred rights. It was an equal protection kind of provision, and Corfield was interpreted that way, as were the other cases which interpreted Article 4 privileges and immunities. The radical Republicans in the Congress, however, loved the language that Justice Washington used in Corfield, his language of fundamental rights which belong, you know, in all free societies and which states had always protected. And they attempted to use the language of Justice Washington and that reading of Article 4 as having to do with fundamental rights as justifying broad federal control over any right that Congress believed was fundamental enough to deserve protecting against state action. And they wanted both to use that power in terms of their statutes and also to draft a constitutional amendment that would give them power to enforce that right against the states. Again, as I understand the record, that approach was consistently rejected, and language which attempted to use or push that position was rejected and taken out of both the Civil Rights Act and the 14th Amendment. And you had constant replies saying, no, that isn't what Corfield was about. That isn't what the Article 4 was about. It had to do with equal protection of state-conferred rights, and we cannot try to expand federal power so broadly as to authorize justices to decide for themselves what fundamental rights ought to be. And that's where I would end at least my portion of this debate, because I think that's really what we're talking about. As much as I certainly appreciate Clark's and his encouragement that we look at the evils to be remedied. And I think he's right. I think that is where we should be looking. But the argument that to some degree he's advocating and that others are advocating wouldn't just authorize the court to remedy whatever evils existed at the time of the 14th Amendment, but in fact would be given full authorization to five justices on the court to decide whatever they thought should be fundamental principles which states had to follow, even if those principles were not a part of the 14th Amendment debate, and even if they're not listed in the Constitution. I think that's a very dangerous approach that's too intrusive on the states and gives too much power to five unelected justices of the court.
Oh, thanks. This is Nelson again. I hate to stop now because I have a lot of questions, and I know that both of you have a lot more to say. But unfortunately, I think our time is up, and I want to thank both of you for what's been a very enlightening discussion, and I know we'll all be looking forward to seeing what the Supreme Court does with this case. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.